This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, the 3rd day of January 2013. I'm Christina Thomas. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, a new look at a medieval art form, Congressman Mike Ross on retirement, and a visit to Crystal Mountain. But first, after rejecting the 2012 Farm Bill in June, Senator John Bozeman said he hopes to gain support for the creation of a new agricultural legislation in the upcoming year. He believes the state's heavily irrigated crops have received little protection under the current commodity title, which acts as a safety net to prevent farmers from experiencing consequences of price declines. The senator also addressed the issue of farmer-consumer relationships and how a 5-year program may bring some insurance.
Farmers need the ability, very soon as they go down to the bankers, and they've got to be able to show the banker the safety net that's in place as they start to borrow money for the next crop season. And so this is something that needs to be done, either an extension for another year, or I would like to see a 5-year program, again, that protects all of the regions of the country as far as their agricultural components.
Bozeman will continue to uphold his ideas for farm bill improvement when Congress resumes. A walk of fame honoring Arkansas's list of celebrated entertainers could soon become part of the cultural scene that is downtown Fayetteville. The proposal heads to the Fayetteville City Council tonight, and if approved, stars honoring the likes of Johnny Cash, Billy Bob Thornton, and John Grisham could start lining streets around the downtown square and Center Street as early as next year. Butch Stone is one of many names readily associated with entertainment in Arkansas. As a former concert promoter and manager of the rock group Black Oak Arkansas, which came to prominence in the early and mid-70s, he decided that the story of entertainers from the natural state should be told.
There are a lot of folks born native to Arkansas that have made a name for themselves in the entertainment industry, either in music, film, the visual arts, or the literary world. But nobody's really telling that story. We have an Arkansas Entertainers Hall of Fame in Pine Bluff, but the story's not being told. And so I realized that I am the person that could begin to tell that story in a new and different way.
Stone is the chair of the nonprofit organization that is devising the Walk of Fame. He says that while other cities, such as Little Rock, North Little Rock, and Conway, were considered as the location for the Arkansas Entertainers Walk of Fame, Fayetteville was ultimately chosen because of a number of factors, including the thriving music scene on Dixon Street, the amount of tourism present in the area, and because of the support expressed by city leaders. Stone says that each year, an inducting committee will select 4 names to be inducted into the Walk of Fame, one each from the categories of music, visual arts, literary arts, and film. The inductees will be honored through placement of a bronze plaque on the walk.
These plaques will have the name of the artist. There will be an icon that will indicate which of these 4 fields they've distinguished themselves in, and then there will be some notice of the sponsor who's sponsoring each of the plaques and everything. And it'll be a yearly event, and I think something that will go on for quite some time in the future. From my point of view, I look at it as part of the legacy I want to leave the state of Arkansas, and it's something that we can be and should be proud of, because there are a lot of folks that have done well in entertainment.
Once the city council gives its stamp of approval, Stone says the nonprofit organization will raise funds and organize a celebration for this summer to commemorate the first round of inductees. Also on the Fayetteville City Council's plate tonight is an update of the city's electronic sign ordinance. Jeremy Pate is the director of the city's Development Services Division. He says that for many years now, the city has prohibited so-called moving signs.
Things that flash or flicker or scroll, everything of those types of nature are prohibited in our ordinance. It's just that the language really reflects an older technology. So you see, you know, references to bulbs and lumens, things of that nature that we really don't see as much in the sign industry any longer because of the move to more LED-type signage. So what this would do is to update, in a lot of ways, that ordinance to bring it up to current technologies in sign manufacturing, but also to clarify that the city of Fayetteville does wish to prohibit those types of messaging for both safety features, factors for drivers, pedestrians, but also for aesthetics.
Not all electric signs are banned in the city. Currently, static message boards are the only type of electronic signage allowed in Fayetteville. Moving signs are only one of the prohibited types of signage in Fayetteville. Pate says that billboards have been banned in the city since the 1970s. 7,100 wreaths were placed on graves at the Fayetteville National Cemetery during the holiday season to honor fallen service members. Normally, those wreaths would end up in the landfill. But a new effort is being held to prevent some of those wreaths from ending up as waste. Janie Bibb is organizing Bo's Project, an effort to recycle as many of those wreaths as possible.
The goal is to try and reuse as much of the wreath as we can to put it back into the environment rather than just have it go into the landfill. It's kind of like a sustainability project. I just didn't want them to go back into the landfill because it is a recyclable product. The wiring can be recycled, the ribbon can be recycled, and the wreath itself, the greenery, would go into the compost pile.
Bibb says that while she doesn't expect to be able to recycle all of the wreaths, many volunteers are needed to help with the effort.
Anybody who can come out and help us gather the wreaths up from the cemetery and help us take them down to the Restoration Church where we're going to work. They've volunteered to let us use their church parking lot, and that'll be our station area. So anybody who can come help us remove the wreaths from the cemetery, take them down there and help us start breaking the wreaths down. We'll need lots of volunteers. If anybody wants to bring coffee or hot chocolate to help support the volunteers, anybody who has trucks or trailers to help us load the wreaths on to move them down to the church.
Bibb organized the recycling effort in honor of her son, Bo Swearingen, who was buried in the National Cemetery after being killed in a car wreck in April of 2010. The dining scene in downtown Bentonville is getting some national recognition. In its 2013 Out and In list, the Washington Post pushed out the Charleston dining scene in favor of the Bentonville dining scene this year. Restaurants such as 11 at Crystal Bridges, Tuscan Trotter, and The Hive, plus the upcoming restaurant at 21C Museum Hotel, were all noted by the publication as signs of the city's burgeoning foodie culture. Tonight's forecast calls for clear skies with overnight lows from 18 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 25 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, Friday, partly cloudy with highs in the mid-40s, which after spending a weekend in Chicago sounds pretty nice. Tomorrow evening, partly cloudy with a 20% chance of snow. Lows from 25 degrees in northwest Arkansas to 28 in the River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas. As the 113th United States Congress is sworn in today, absent from their ranks will be Congressman Mike Ross, who served Arkansas's 4th Congressional District for 12 years. Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net spoke with Congressman Ross just as 2012 was drawing to a close.
Congressman Ross, you are poised for retirement here at the end of 2012. Do you remember your first political job? What was the first thing you did that helped you catch the political bug?
Well, it was in 1981. Bill Clinton had been governor. He got beat. He was running again. And his motorcade and security detail consisted of me. It was a Chevy Citation. And we drove around Arkansas asking people to give him a second chance. And it was through that I really began to take up an interest in public life and public service and realize that, you can really make a difference in people's lives by getting involved in public service and by running for office. And, you know, back then there was still a perception that politics was not a dirty word. It was considered a noble profession back then, and unfortunately it's not anymore. But you know, I try to remind folks there's bad apples in every profession, every career, and there's still a lot of good people out there that put themselves in front of the public and make the financial and the family sacrifices to get involved for the right reasons, to make a difference in people's lives and to provide ordinary people with a voice, and people can still do that.
You left one of the cushiest political jobs in the world, the Arkansas State Senate, to run for the U.S. Congress, I believe in the year 2000. What possessed you that year?
Well, we had a thing in actually at the beginning of my last legislative session in the state Senate, I had resigned to the fact that that I was going to get out of politics. I was wrapping up 10 years in the state Senate. 2 years into my tenure in the state Senate, the Arkansas voters passed term limits, and so basically, in the year 2000, I was only 39 years old, and yet I found myself in a position where the only people in my state Senate district that were ineligible to run were those under age 25 convicted felons and me as a result of the term limits law. And I felt like I still had something to offer. And back then, Kevin Smith, who was in the state Senate from Stuttgart, and Jay Bradford, who was in the state Senate from Pine Bluff, they really encouraged me to run for Congress in 2000. And, you know, I knew it was an uphill battle. I was running against an incumbent congressman that was on Appropriations Committee. He'd already raised like $1 million in his campaign fund. But, you know, I felt like I didn't have anything to lose because if I lost, I was going to be out of politics and by the same way that I would be if I didn't run. And so I ran and gave it my all, and with the help of a lot of people, we squeaked by and won that election in 2000, and here we are 12 years later. You know, 10 years in the state Senate, 12 years in the Congress, and it seems like that first race for the state Senate was only yesterday, but it's been 22 years.
What are you maybe proudest of in terms of votes you cast, legislation you helped get accomplished, just things that you'll say, I'll definitely hang my hat on that hook right there?
You know, I've thought a lot about that, and I don't think there's any one thing you can name. I can tell you I'm proud that we, during my time there, we raised the minimum wage, we cut student loan interest rates in half, we passed the single largest increase in veterans health care funding in the history of the VA. So those are, and keeping America safe in this post 9/11 era, I think if we were honest with one another, I think on September 11th, 2001 or September 12th, 2001, you know, if you went out on the street and asked people, do you think there will be another attack on America this decade, I think most people would have said yes. And hopefully the things that we have done, the policies that we have passed have helped make America more safe. I'm not going to sit here and tell you there'll never be another terrorist attack on America. We live among the freest people in the world, and we can't let our guard down. But I, you know, I'm proud of the things that we've done to try to keep America safe in this post 9/11 era. So those are probably some of the more significant things from a policy perspective. I can tell you. You know, a lot of people think the health care debate was one of the toughest things we dealt with. It was actually the recession. And I took a big hit for it. I mean, people to this day continue to criticize me for some of the votes that I made under President Bush in 2007, under President Obama in 2008. But I'm telling you that I was in a lot of closed-door meetings with economists that aren't Democrats or Republicans. There was no debate over whether we were headed for a deep recession and probably a depression. The only debate in that room among the economists was whether we were days away or weeks away, and that was the time frame we were looking at. And I know there's people that think we voted to bail out banks. Well, first of all, it wasn't a bailout; it was a loan, and they're paying them back with interest. Some of them paid it all back now, and it was never about the banks. I mean, at the time, something like 70%, I may have these numbers a little wrong because I'm a little rusty with them, but something like 70% of all home mortgages were held by like five or six banks. Mm-hmm. I think something like 80% of all deposits in America were held by 20 banks or less. You know, it was about working people. It was about their deposits. It was about their home mortgage. It was never about the banks. Same thing with the auto bailout. I mean, it was never about, you know, the car manufacturers. It was about the people that worked there and the huge ripple effect that can have. I mean, we had a plant in my district that made the gasoline caps that go on the gasoline tank on cars. Hundreds of people would have lost their jobs had we lost the auto industry in this country. And I also think that it would have been a huge mistake to rely on other countries for the production of our automobiles over here. But those were difficult votes. They were controversial votes. And like I said, people continue to criticize me for them to this day, but I'm absolutely convinced that had we not done the things that we did, as unpopular as they might have been at the time, we would have had a much deeper recession and perhaps a depression.
Do you regret any votes? Do you regret any action or inaction, things that you wish you had accomplished during your time there?
Well, I regret my vote on going to war in Iraq. I sat in the White House with the president, and I'll never forget what he said. He said that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and if military force is required, it will be swift, was the word he gave us. And, of course, we just recently got out. That was, you know, a quote from 2001, 2002, and we just recently got out of that war. I mean, I think whether the president was making his decision on faulty intelligence or not is something perhaps we'll never know, but I can assure you that I was making my decision based on what has become clearly known as faulty intelligence. And, you know, look, there's evil dictators all over the world. There's no doubt Saddam was an evil guy, but he didn't have nuclear weapons. He didn't have weapons of mass destruction. And, America has paid the price through the loss of lives, through soldiers that are injured in ways that will forever change their lives, and through the enormous amount of money we spent, which helped contribute to this debt that we have today and fighting that war. And like I said, there's evil dictators all over the world, but we can't police the world. I think had we not done what we did in Iraq, I think we could have perhaps been more focused on what we were doing in Afghanistan, which I certainly supported. But again, I think the Afghanistan war, you know, it should have come to an end when we were successful in bringing Osama bin Laden to justice. That was really all about. And I think we sent a pretty clear message to terrorists all over the world that no matter what it cost, in terms of money or lives of our brave soldiers, you do harm to America, we will hunt you down and we will bring you to justice. And to me, that once we were successful in doing that was the time to begin a responsible strategy to pull out of Afghanistan.
Tell me what you're going to be doing post-politics and what you're looking forward to doing post-politics.
Well, I'm looking forward to having more time with my family, and I'm looking forward to getting my life back, if you will. You know, in politics, a lot of people understand this, some don't, but I mean, serving in Congress is like three full-time jobs. You've got the job to do in Washington, and you're away from your family, in my case, more than 1,000 miles away from my family, 3, 4, or 5 nights a week. And then when you're home, you're not really home. You know, a typical day home for me was 200 to 300 miles in a car, anywhere from 4 to 6 town hall meetings. And then somewhere in between all that, you've got to raise $3 million, which is just, you know, unbelievable and ridiculous. But you got to raise about $3 million for TV and direct mail and radio and all that comes with it, you know, because you raise your right hand, take the oath of office, you're literally 15 months from the filing deadline to run again. So I'm looking forward to having a normal life, living in the private sector again. And you know, I'll tell you, and I've thought a lot about this, because I know it's going to be a transition for me and an adjustment, having been in public life for 22 years now. But I can tell you there are a lot of people in Arkansas that do a lot of good that have never run for office. And I look forward to becoming one of them. I'm only 51. I'm a long way away from retirement. I may be retiring from Congress, but I'm not retiring from life. And, you know, and I want to continue to find ways to give back. I want to be involved in some charities and some nonprofit work where I can. I'd like to be involved in helping shape policy for our state that I love so much. But there's a lot of people that do those things without putting their name on the ballot, and I look forward to being a part of that group.
You have declined to run for governor in 2014. Do you see yourself taking part in that race in some way, shape, fashion, or form?
Not really. You know, I struggled with that. I would have loved to have run for governor in 2014 and had a lot of encouragement to do it. My decision not to was pretty simple. I was convinced that I could not run for governor if I was in Washington voting three or four nights a week. And so I actually left Congress. You know, I never thought that my time in Washington should become a permanent career. In fact, I think that's part of the problem with Washington is some people go up there and stay too long. But I left with the idea that that I would probably run for governor of the state. And then it hit me that, you know, I've got to figure out a way to make a living during this two-year race for governor. And you can't really take a job because, one, if you do, everyone will say it's a conflict. Someone's trying to buy you for in case you're the next governor. And the other part of it is that, I mean, running for governor is 6 a.m. to midnight for two solid years. So you really can't have another job. And you know, and it would have been very difficult for me and my family to simply try to live off savings and get by for those 2 years. So in a lot of ways, you either have to have a political job in Arkansas that you can have while you run, or you got to be independently wealthy. And I didn't fit either one of those categories, and so for me, not running in 2014 was the best decision for me and my family. But I would have loved to have served.
Should we say never about your potential re-entry into politics someday?
Well, I'm only 51, and so I mean, you never say never, but I have no plans to get back into public life at any point in the future. I'm excited about the future. I'm joining Southwest Power Pool here in Little Rock. They're a nonprofit organization. You know, public service has always been an important part of my life, and it will continue to be because what they do in ensuring that we have the electricity we need now and for the future and at affordable rates, I think is a very important public service. And the fact that they are a nonprofit organization was certainly appealing to me. Look, I had a lot of job opportunities in Washington where I could have made a lot more money, but there's more to life than money. And Arkansas is home. I'm a fifth-generation Arkansan. I love this state. I love to hunt. I love to fish. I love to go to Razorback football games. And I wasn't gonna move to Virginia. I'm staying. My family and I made a conscious decision to stay here in Arkansas because we love the state, we love its people, and like I said, there's a lot of ways to serve your state without putting your name on the ballot, and I look forward to
Roby Brock of our content partner TalkBusiness.net spoke with Congressman Mike Ross late in 2012. Support for TalkBusiness.net on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the United States. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com. Support comes from Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at BankOzarks.com. And Verizon, offering a wide selection of productivity-enhancing tablets for small business, including the Apple iPad. More information at a Verizon Communications store near you or online at vzw.com/smallbusiness. And CEG Partners, using empirical data to better understand your customers' experiences and their loyalties. More information at cegpartners.com. Next on Ozarks at Large, we go to a unique geolocation in eastern Carroll County. On the map, it's marked as Gage Mountain, but locals have long referred to it as Crystal Mountain. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich discovered, crystals from that mountain were long ago harvested and used for a noble purpose.
We're on a place called Crystal Mountain. It's a summit in southern Carroll County. We're at about 1,785 feet above sea level, and it's a rugged oak, pine, hickory forest, lots of wildlife, a lot of farms. But according to the locals, the eastern slope of this mountain is also loaded with quartz crystal.
Now, the crystal clear prismatic elongate quartz, you know, like you see in the rock shops, but rock quartz, chunks of flat stones holding shallow arrays of embedded crystals. And some stonemason who lived in the area in the early 1930s decided to gather up a truckload of this quartz-covered rock and haul it to Green Forest to decorate the front gable of the historic American Legion post. And on a sunny day, the facade just sparkles.
I had never really noticed it sparkling before.
That's Furman High of the High Clan, German Dutch who homesteaded at Oak Grove in the early 1800s, just northwest of Berryville. He's a relative of Fred High and his sister Mary High Briscoe, who were popular ballad singers at the historic Ozark folk festivals in the 1950s. Furman was born 1930, farm-raised, and he's a craftsman, a woodworker, who creates one-of-a-kind hardwood furniture. Several of his pieces adorn the American Legion Hall. The Legion was established in Green Forest in 1923, and the hall constructed a decade later. Over the years, it served as a community center and library. Flags line the walls, along with lots of photos of post veterans. We take a seat at a long banquet table covered in a red, white, and blue tablecloth to visit.
Well, I first worked up here. The guy I worked with, he is in the Legion here, said, "You want me to join?" And he got, "No, you're not eligible." And they had their stricter dates on it some way, but then they finally loosened it on up. In later years there, anybody that's honorable discharge can belong to the American Legion if they want to now.
This Legion Hall was once inhabited by World War I and II veterans, but they're all gone now, Furman says. Still, this Legion Hall counts 50 members, veterans ranging in age from their 20s into their 80s. Plus, they have a ladies' auxiliary.
And how often do you meet here?
Once a month, first Tuesday of each month.
And what do you do?
Different things, you know, that's coming up or something we're going to do or what. Well, we have what we call a district meeting every 3 months, I think it is.
Green Forest's American Legion Hall was almost lost to decay until Furman High rallied volunteers and money to restore the 22-by-70-foot-long hall about 10 years ago. But Furman says over the years, post members have raised lots of money for local charities and lent support.
That's what we would do if some veteran come to us needing some help some way. Well, we would try to help him or get him in a VA hospital if that's what he needed or whatever. And so anyway, I feel like that's our purpose.
The emblem of the American Legion, which is fixed to the quartz crystal facade of this building, features a sunburst providing courage to all combat soldiers, a central wreath to commemorate servicemen and women lost in battle, and a large star, which reflects honor, glory, and constancy. Furman High served during the Korean War.
I took basic training in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. 8 weeks, and then the second 8 weeks down there, and then I spent 18 months in Schofield Barracks, Hawaii.
In the mid-1950s on the island of Oahu, established in 1908 to provide mobile defense to Pearl Harbor. It's home of the 25th Infantry Division, the Tropic Lightning Division.
It wasn't a little heavier weapon than what the main front lines. We were right close behind them, really, what was, and we recoilless rifle that was mounted on a Jeep at the time. And then they had the mortars, which I was in the mortars division of it.
Furman served as transportation corporal until he was discharged. He left Hawaii to come back to Green Forest, where he married Imogene Davis, now deceased, and raised three sons, Randy, Denny, and Tim. Furman worked at the local lumber yard for more than a decade, then later drove for the poultry industry until he retired. Randy High, who operated a flower shop next door to the Legion Hall for many years, now works for the Carroll County Historical Society in Berryville. So we go back outside in front of the building to look up and ask what he knows about the rock crystal adornment.
Well, on the history thing, it said it was off of Gage Mountain or Crystal Mountain, Berryville. So that's all that we know. It was took off the old minutes. So.
One thing Randy is sure about is that the Legion Hut was a dedicated Works Progress Administration project, 1930s Depression-era federally funded program, to stimulate local economies and provide work. In this part of the Ozarks, the vernacular architecture found on or near town squares features single and double-story narrow but long-cut sandstone block buildings. Some are also faced with rock rubble or flagstone cemented into the surface. Randy High.
Most of the blocks were quarried out at Denver over on Dry Creek. There's just a big old hole they call the quarry over there. And they hauled them into Green Forest and built the buildings out of them.
Randy High says while many of the local Green Forest families have stayed on, supported by a booming poultry industry, many historic structures have disappeared.
There used to be some really nice homes, but they've tore them down and built new houses or something. But when I was a kid, there was a lot of nice big houses here in town. Some of them have burnt, but we had some nice Victorian type houses here in town.
But the Legion Hut still stands with its crystal embellishment. Pure silica quartz grows underground in dark voids, caves, and channels where translucent six-sided prismatic points emerge. Quartz comes in a variety of sizes and colors, rose, amethyst, citrine, smoky brown, and milk quartz. Some of the finest quartz in the world is mined on the eastern Ouachita Range around Hot Springs, but you can see specimens of rock quartz found only at certain elevations in Carroll County on the front gable of the Jordan Davis American Legion Post 162 in Green Forest. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
A triptych is a work of art, usually a panel painting, which is divided into three panels. Art historian and assistant professor at the University of Arkansas, Lynn Jacobs, takes a closer look at this unique art form in her book Opening Doors, the early Netherlandish triptych reinterpreted. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellams recently spoke with the scholar. Kyle began the conversation by pointing out that the term triptych didn't even exist when much of the art examined in the book was created.
When I first started working on this book, I was kind of floundering around. I knew I wanted to work on the triptych, but I wasn't exactly sure where I wanted to go with it. So for me, one of the things that really grounds me is to go back and read the documents of the period. So I started to go back and read all this material, contracts and wills and all sorts of archival material to try to get a better grip on what people in the period were thinking about. And unfortunately, in most of these 15th century documents, they don't tell you a whole lot. It's very brief. There's not a lot of information. And I started to notice, though, this idea that there was no word triptych. I mean, when we have the word triptych, it has tri in it, so we think of it as three. And so we think of it as being three things. And so many people, just in looking at this, said, oh, well, triptych, it's meant to symbolize a trinity. And so that was just kind of dismissed. And then when I started to see that they never used this term, I realized that the term that they used was generally a painting with doors, and that's sort of the basis for the title, Opening Doors. And when you think about something, it's not really conceived in three parts. It's conceived of this main panel, and then there are kind of doors opening into that. And I started then to really think about, you know, what does it mean to think about a painting that way? When they're conceiving it this way, what are they thinking about? And that got me into a whole lot of research on just the meaning of doors and the meaning of doors in medieval culture. And so I did a lot of research on symbolism of the doors, ritual practices around doors, So in the book, there's material on things like how when in certain monasteries, when you wanted to join the monastery, you had to knock on the door multiple times before they would let you in, and that was a symbolic of your entering the monastery. Or rituals for consecrating churches where the priests would go around banging on the doors and saying prayers at the doors. And also it kind of brought me into studying anthropological studies of doors and thresholds and the use of doors symbolism in rites of passage. And so that became a real basis for the way I started to look at these works.
These triptychs, of course, have the larger center art, and then on the side in wings or doors. You write that on one hand, there's a practical use for this is because you could close it up and keep dust off of it.
Yeah. I mean, everything has a number of functions, and this was very practical because it did protect the inner panel. And generally from studies, we know that the outsides of these works are more damaged than the insides typically. So it really did serve its function to protect it, protect it from dust, to protect it from getting smashed. Also, it's a very useful thing for transporting these works because it makes them, you know, smaller, and you can pack them up. And a lot of these works were sold all over Europe. So that's another practical function. And a third practical function is that you could have additional imagery. So most of these Netherlanders triptychs have stuff painted on the exteriors. A lot of times that has actually been lost and damaged and
painted over and
it adds a different dimension. And we do think that it, in certain kind of ritual uses, the wings would have been closed, for example, during Lent as a penitential season, and so that served a kind of liturgical function, but also it had a dramatic function that when you open them up, you saw something different. There was this kind of revelation of the interior. And just as we know in this gift-giving and gift-getting season, the whole process of opening up your presents is so much better than if somebody just handed you the present without
right.
any wrapping or box or something. And so, too, with this imagery on the insides of these triptychs, there's this sense of sanctity and importance that comes from the fact that you don't always see that imagery and that you have to open up these doors to see them.
The many works of art that are in this book, Opening Doors, often the sides, the doors, have a different scene or an extension of a scene. And that's when a lot of the interesting interpretation and figuring out what the artist is doing in the formation really comes into this book, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there are lots of different ways that artists can handle this format, and it was a very popular format in the 15th and 16th centuries in Northern Europe. So there are a lot of permutations. One of the really interesting ones and common ones is the idea that the donor, the person who paid for the work, would have their portraits and portraits of their family members painted on the wings, and they would face into the center and towards the center. And one of the things you have to realize is that a lot of these works of art, and the purpose, the reason for which they were being painted, was for this person to get a certain amount of bonus points towards their sort of their tally of good deeds. And commissioning art or having art for a church could be a means of considered a good work, and it was considered a means of a sort of increasing your chances of salvation after death. So many of the wealthier people did this, and this was probably a motivation for them. And so the presence of their portraits on the wings allows them to be in a kind of perpetual prayer to the holy figures that are in the center. It also allows them to communicate their desire for salvation, and some of the ways that the works are structured with certain connections between their panel and the central panel, I think, is a way of imaging the hopes of the people who paid for the triptychs and their desire for salvation.
I don't know what this says about me. I have two favorites that are in this book, and it's a beautiful book. One, and forgive the pronunciation here, Hans
Memling.
Memling. Mm-hmm. And it's I can open it up. It's very colorful, and it's some people might find it disturbing. You know which one I'm talking about? It's, let's see, where are the color plates?
Is that the Last Judgment?
Yes, The Last Judgment. There's so much happening.
That's pretty wild.
It is. I mean, there are damned souls, and I'm assuming you're seeing hell. And
absolutely. I mean, this is a really fantastic Last Judgment triptych. And, of course, for the Last Judgment subject matter, the triptych is perfect because you have your central panel with the judging, and then your left panel, which is on Christ's right side, that is his good side, is going to be your heaven, and the right panel will be your hell. And so this is a perfect format for this type of subject matter, although you could certainly do it in a single panel. It really works great this way. And it's pretty wild. There's a lot going on, but I love this triptych too. What happens over the course of the 15th century is there is this kind of great increasing interest in more narrative and more detail, and you do often have a buildup of figures like this. But, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about these triptychs is, you know, you really think about what people at the time would have thought about when they were seeing this. And we're talking about cultures where you don't have all this imagery around them. You don't have all, you know, the internet with, you know, and multiple windows and signs and billboards and magazines and newspapers. I mean, you really are having an environment where these images would have been, you know, in a relatively limited image environment. And then you have people who really were believing in this kind of hell with fire and brimstone and tortures as similar to what's depicted here. So the impact of this, I think, would have been amazing and on the people of that time. And so that desire, I think, to act in such a way so that they'll be able to pass between the panels and onto the image of heaven, I think, would have been profoundly important. And, of course, one of the things about the 15th century that we have to realize is their idea of heaven was not a bunch of little babies floating around on clouds. They thought of heaven as a city, as a heavenly Jerusalem. And so it was conceived that you would, and we have this too, this idea still, that you're going to go through the gates of heaven, but you're going to go into a city. And so in terms of this imagery of doors and thresholds, you see on the wing of the triptych, that is what people would have seen as the door, you see the door that is the entrance into heaven. So it really communicates that point and that desire for transcendence in a kind of ritual process through a rite of passage through from life into salvation.
I also like Garden of Earthly Delights, Hieronymus
Bosch.
Hieronymus Bosch. Again, a lot is happening in that.
That is, of course, that is probably one of my favorite triptychs. And a lot of students of this particular period just, love that triptych. The triptych is, you cannot imagine how many books have been written on that.
Solely on
that. On that triptych, yeah. I mean, it is probably one of the most perplexing in terms of its imagery. I don't think anybody has fully successfully explained it, and I don't claim to either. But it's very unusual in the history of triptychs because it's huge, first of all. You would be shocked at how big it is. It's really, really big. And it has all this imagery of naked people cavorting around doing very unusual things that you don't normally see, certainly in an altarpiece. So a huge debate is, what was the function of this? And I think I took the position, and other people have, but some people have disagreed, that this could not have been in a church context. This must have been in more of a probably aristocratic milieu, that an aristocrat owned this, and that it was actually a kind of history of the world and from Bosch, that's pretty much his approach is a history of sin. So it's a history of the kind of decay of civilization. But it's an amazing piece.
Finally, do you ever allow yourself to imagine what art historians 500 years from now might think of our contemporary art?
Well, I really try to stay away from contemporary art. You know, I've always said I like to work on artists who can't talk back. Although I must admit that I, you know, when I go into sometimes in these Belgian towns, and some of these are just medieval towns, and I'm walking down some of these streets, and I think, man, Roger van der Weyden walked down the street. Jan van Eyck might have walked down the
right
street.
Right on this spot.
And it's just kind of mind-boggling for me, and sometimes I have this incredible desire that if only I could meet them. But I think that things have changed so much in art, and contemporary art is such a different thing in a way. I mean, one of the things I tell my students is there really weren't any starving artists until the 19th century. Mm-hmm. These artists in the 15th and 16th centuries that I work on, I mean, they were all recognized in their own time as these great artists, and they worked for major patrons, oftentimes for the rulers. Some of them were court painters. So this whole idea that you know, art is challenging everybody's idea of what is art, and all the questions that have come up with contemporary art are really different from the period that I work on. I definitely have a feeling that 500 years from now, there'll be different views about what's being produced today than we have now. But I don't know how different the views will be of 15th century
right.
painting. It's kind of, I think it's an interesting question. Maybe people will have just totally different ideas about them too. So, I mean, that is, I think, one of the exciting things about scholarship is that it keeps moving on. And as a scholar, I just hope that I can kind of contribute a few drops into that river of scholarship that help push it forward or contribute to the body of knowledge that we have. And it's just very exciting to me and a privilege to me to be able to make any kind of contribution. And I hope this book does that.
The book is Opening Doors. Congratulations. It's a beautiful, wonderful book.
Thank you very much.
Lynn Jacobs is the author of Opening Doors, the Early Netherlandish Triptych Reinterpreted. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellum spoke with her last month. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Beth Bobbitt, Public Relations Manager with Walton Arts Center. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, so we've just kind of gotten back to work after a long holiday break, and the Walton Arts Center was closed and kind of slow.
Right, and yes, we've picked things back up. Got a couple shows in January. Right away, we have Catch Me If You Can next week. We've got 8 performances, January 8th through the 13th. And this show, have you seen the movie?
I have seen the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio,
yes.
Tom Hanks.
So it is based on that movie. It follows pretty closely to the storyline. It's a fascinating story. It's inspired by the real life of Frank Abagnale Jr. And spoiler alert, you know, for those that haven't seen the movie, but he forged and cashed about $2.5 million worth of bad checks, posed as an airline pilot, doctor, lawyer, all before the age of 21. And
this was what, in the 60s?
It was
so
in the
60s. That's a lot of money,
it's
$2 million.
It's a lot of money now,
right.
Let alone back then, yeah.
Right.
So ultimately he was caught and served time in prison, and now he's actually working with the FBI. This guy has a really fascinating life. So I love the story itself. But for Broadway lovers, it's kind of that Broadway-Hollywood dream team because the creative staff have worked on everything. The directors, Jack O'Brien from Hairspray, The Full Monty. The choreographer is Jerry Mitchell, who is working on Kinky Boots on Broadway right now. So it's really, the music is all original. It's got that jazzy 60s swinging, you know, fun feel. The costumes are great. The girls are leggy. It's just a fun, just really wonderful show.
So we say leggy. Can we imagine, you know, some fun kind of kicks?
Lots of kick lines and lots of fun costumes. And, yeah, it'll just take you back to the 60s. Very retro feeling.
I'm imagining bright colors
yes.
and whatnot, too.
Yes. Yeah. Their artwork has, you know, it's like bright pink, blues, So it's very bright and splashy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that starts on?
The 8th.
On the 8th.
Yes. And it runs through the 13th. And I do want to mention we have this really fun contest. We've never really done anything like this. But if you buy tickets, you can register online, use the code GETAWAY, or by phone. And that registers you to win 2 airline tickets to anywhere in the U.S. But the deadline is tomorrow, Friday, January 4th, for that.
Okay. So buy your ticket today or tomorrow.
Yes.
And you automatically get registered for 2 plane tickets to anywhere?
Yes.
In the United States.
Big prize.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. And then January is, you know, it's kind of slow. We're getting...
Right.
There's getting back into the groove of things.
We've got one more show in January. The Oberlin Dance Collective is here. They present The Velveteen Rabbit, which is, again, based on the book and, you know, brings these characters to life on stage. What's really fun about this show is that we use local dancers in the performance, in both the school performances and the public performances. So we've auditioned these, you know, these kids. They have this great skill set for dancing, and they get this real-life theater experience. So that's kind of cool to have that local.
The Velveteen Rabbit, it's sort of a sad story.
It is, but it's heartwarming at the same time. Yeah. And yeah.
So this is, so then this will be a kid-friendly show then?
Yes, 5 and up. It's appropriate, you know, bring your infants. It's a $10 ticket, so, you know, it's great for an introduction if your child has never seen anything live.
Okay, and when is that?
January 19th.
January 19th.
Yes.
Okay. And then that's followed by, there's a Sona performance, I believe. Do you?
Correct. Yes. That, I don't know if I have the date. So check our website.
Okay.
The
okay.
Sona
we'll
website
check it. We'll
that.
Check it.
Yes. And then I also wanted to mention we had Cedar Lake, the ballet company here, and that show has been canceled. So if you do have tickets, you should have been notified, but just know that.
Right.
That
if you have a program or something,
right.
Don't expect to walk up and
exactly.
buy tickets. Okay.
Exactly.
All right. And then it looks like things pick up pretty quickly next month. The
yes.
next Broadway show is
Memphis. Yeah. At the beginning of February 5th through the 10th, which is my all-time favorite Broadway show. It is phenomenal. It's like this bluesy, you know, it's all about the music and the time during the 50s in Memphis. We also have Voces 8, February 15th. Potted Potter on the 16th and 17th. We had 3 performances
now,
of that.
I've been driving by West Street and, you know, by the Walton Arts Center
yes.
on West Street, and I've seen the, I guess, the poster for it.
Right.
What is Potted
this
Potter?
This show is hilarious. It's... Okay, so it's all 7 books done in 70 minutes by 2 actors. And so it's comedy, it's improv, it's going to be hilarious. They say they have a lot of interactive elements, a game of Quidditch. So for Harry Potter fans and just, you know, people that are young at heart, this is going to be a great. Then we have Grace Kelly Quintet, February the 16th. That's a great jazz show. She's this 20-year-old saxophone prodigy. She's amazing. The Little Prince on February 19th. And then
that's
we
one
have,
of my favorites.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I've never actually read the book. We were just talking about that. Well, yeah, that'll be great. And then Hair, February 22nd and 23rd. And that brings us into March.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Busy time.
Yeah. And people can find out more?
Yes, waltonartcenter.org or calling the box office at 443-5600.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
Beth Bobbitt is Public Relations Manager with Walton Arts Center. And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Green Forest. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Tomorrow, Friday, my co-host Kyle Kellums will be joining me for an all-new edition of Daily Ozarks. For now, happy Thursday, and thank you so much for listening.